This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
Hello again, Lynn Malcolm with you for All in the Mind. And today, epilepsy, a brain condition shrouded in mystery.
There was a time, you know, when people used to refer to these people as being psychiatrically disturbed or, for example, possessed by the devil.
As far back as Hippocrates, the great Greek physician 2,000 years ago, he recognised that epilepsy did have a tendency to be inherited. But unfortunately, through much of the subsequent 2,000 years, there was a lot of mythology and superstition and prejudice against people with epilepsy.
What is unique about epilepsy is that it occurs suddenly and unpredictably. And I think the mystery of it that it conjures up lies in that fact. I think the brain is often considered a black box. So there's lots of room for further research, and the pleasing thing is that people around the world are trying to tackle that.
Epilepsy specialists Sam Berkovic and Annie By. It's thought that epilepsy is the most common neurological disorder of the brain, affecting around 40 million people globally. And even though great improvements have been made in our understanding of the condition in the last 15 years, there's still a lot we don't know. Today we'll hear about the latest approaches to this intriguing disorder, and shortly we'll hear a young girl's account of her struggle with epilepsy. First though, what is this condition? Professor Sam Berkovic from the Epilepsy Research Centre at the University of Melbourne.
It's defined as the tendency to take recurrent epileptic seizures. And epileptic seizures come in a variety of types. The best known type is the major convulsion, or what used to be called grand mal, and we call a tonic-clonic seizure, where the patient will suddenly, often without warning, literally be seized and go into a state where their muscles are contracting, what we call a tonic phase, and then they jerk, and that's the clonic phase. And this whole horrible thing lasts about 60 seconds, after which they may be extremely confused and need to sleep for a day or so. And that's what most people know as a seizure. But there are a whole variety of other, perhaps less spectacular varieties, which affect different parts of the brain. And fundamentally, the brain works by the nerve cells communicating with each other by little electrical and chemical signals. And when that communication system becomes disrupted, and there's literally, if you like, a brainstorm in a colloquial sense, that's what a seizure is. It's an uncontrolled burst of abnormal electrical activity.
And for those who experience epilepsy, it can have a devastating effect on their lives.
I'm Gail Williams and I'm 16 years old.
Hi, my name is Jenny Williams. I'm Gail's mum.
Gail, can you tell me when you first had an epileptic seizure?
Well, I was only about 4 years old when I first started having seizures. And at the time, I would tell my mum that I was sad and my eyes would deviate to the left. And that's all I can really remember as well.
And how often would that happen?
At the time, about every 10 minutes when I was first diagnosed.
Jenny, tell me what it was like when Gail was first having the seizures. What did you observe?
Well, with Gail, it wasn't just an onset of seizures. She was actually sick, so I took her to the hospital. And whilst we were there, she had a tonic-clonic seizure. Her body started shaking and
That's a very frightening thing to observe.
It was, yes. It was one of the worst days of my life, but luckily that was the only one that she did have. The rest were just the petite mal seizures after that.
More from Gail Williams later. The causes of epilepsy range from some form of brain injury through to unknown and possibly genetic factors. And as Gail experienced, seizures can vary from the petit mal type through to the grand mal seizure, depending on what part of the brain is affected. And I must say, the first time I saw a child having a grand mal seizure, I couldn't imagine that he could come out of it, at least without brain damage. Dr. Annie By from the Prince of Wales Children's Hospital in Sydney specialises in childhood epilepsy.
That's a universal response. It's very frightening to see a grand mal seizure, meaning a generalised seizure in which someone goes stiff and shakes and doesn't have awareness and may lose colour and may wet themselves. And virtually every mother will feel that their child is going to die. And I've seen many, many seizures through the work that I do and would continue to find it distressing and upsetting. It's just a fact of life. However, it is rare to die in a seizure, though there is a risk, particularly in the grand mal or generalised seizures that we've just been describing. It is the reason why certain precautions are taken, the strict rules about driving, and of course water, because if you have a fit in the water, the likelihood of drowning is high. Unless there is someone right there to help you, there is the risk. What I think you're also asking in your question is the potential the person comes out of the seizure, which is by far the most likely thing that's going to happen. Most seizures are brief seizures that terminate of themselves and the person recovers with no damage whatsoever. There's a lot of research and discussion about whether continued recurrent seizures, for example, cause further damage and affect memory. And there is probably the potential to do that over the very long term. But I think it's important to remember epilepsy is common, seizures are common. The vast majority of seizures don't cause immediate damage to the brain. For the person themselves, it's not only the seizures that matter, that very often children or teenagers or adults with seizures have other issues such as difficulties in learning, difficulties in behaviour, issues related to medication, self-esteem, depression. And it's all of these issues that need to be managed just as much as the seizure.
Dr. Annie Bye. Now back to Gail Williams, who continued throughout her childhood to have petit mal or partial seizures, which would begin with strange hallucinations known as an aura.
They would start with just this feeling that they're going to happen, which was the aura.
What's your aura like?
I would see flashing colours and lights, rather, and then this dizzy feeling, which I would call fit dizzy. And then I'd say, Mum, I'm having a fit or I'm having a seizure. And I would see different objects and images. A couple of times I saw a rainbow on my dad's steering wheel. Other times I saw the fit man.
The fit man? What does the fit man look like?
The fit man was just an ordinary man. But when I saw this man, I sort of felt like everything was safe and nothing was going to hurt me. And a couple of times I saw the fit lady as well. And she told me that she was my friend and that she liked me. Another time I saw stars doing backflips. That was at soccer training after having a seizure.
Wow.
So just all these different images that I would tell people about but not recall them after having a seizure.
The aura is what many people experience as a warning that a seizure is coming on. But Dr. Ernie Somerville, director of the Comprehensive Epilepsy Service at Sydney's Prince of Wales Hospital, says that the aura is actually the start of the seizure itself.
What happens is that the seizure has started in just a small area of the brain. So the rest of the brain's functioning normally, so the patient remains awake, can talk, can describe what they're experiencing, and can remember it afterwards. Once the seizure activity spreads through the brain, then the patient loses consciousness and can't remember what's happened. The actual content of the aura depends on which part of the brain is involved in the beginning of that seizure. If it's the part of the brain that's concerned with vision, they may see flashing lights or coloured shapes or all sorts of things. And if it's the part of the brain that's concerned with memory, the temporal lobe, then they can experience déjà vu or have memories come back to them. Funny smells is another one. Patients, for example, can have the feeling that they're standing outside their body looking at themselves. Or they can have the feeling that there's somebody behind them. Just about anything that your brain is capable of can be the aura for a seizure. And very commonly, patients have enormous difficulty putting into words what it is that they're experiencing.
So it's no wonder that epilepsy has this sort of mystical feeling around it.
Well, that's right. I mean, that's one of the things that makes the study of epilepsy fascinating, because it just shows what the human brain's capable of. And there's just an enormous array of bizarre things that can happen.
So what's the most common form of treatment for epilepsy? Dr. Annie Bai says that the first line of treatment is medication.
Of all of those with epilepsy, and 1 to 2% of the population have epilepsy, so it's not an uncommon problem, approximately two-thirds will be easily controlled with one or two medications. And that's a very important message to establish. There are a group of children or adults who are harder control, who even with medication and numbers of trials, seizures continue to occur.
And this is despite the plethora of new drugs which have been developed in an attempt to improve treatment, and particularly to cut down on some of the side effects many people experience with epilepsy medication. Dr. Ernie Somerville says that it's disappointing that the new drugs haven't provided a more effective solution.
There's a lot of people where, if we treat them with the new drugs, their seizures will lessen in number. But what's really important for patients is for their seizures to stop completely. And unfortunately, we can only achieve that in 5 to 10% of patients. So that is, of those patients where the older drugs have not been effective and we try the newer drugs, only 5 to 10% of those people will have a complete cessation of their seizures.
So there's still a group of people that just can't be treated by medication effectively.
Yes, that's right. There's still, unfortunately, a hard core of patients that are pretty resistant to therapy.
So at some point in your life, you started to have the fits regardless of the medication, is that right?
Yes. When I was about 13, I started having seizures just constantly, even though I was taking my medication.
How often?
About 2 to 3 times a day. I had to take higher doses of medication, change medications all the time, so it was affecting my learning from the side effects of the medication. I was missing days off school. I just basically emotionally wasn't there, so I just couldn't participate in social events. It's like a walking zombie.
Jenny, what was it like for you at this stage watching Gail go through this?
It was frightening, not knowing sort of what the next step was going to be, because the seizures were getting worse. Like, they were lasting 3 to 5 minutes, a lot of them, which after one she would have to sleep for sometimes up to 4 hours. So it was a very difficult time.
Okay, so when the fits became uncontrolled at around the age of 13, what did the doctor suggest then?
He suggested epilepsy surgery. And when I first heard about it, I was a little bit frightened, I will admit. Then I was eventually just hopeful that there was an answer to what was going on.
In a small percentage of cases like Gail's, epilepsy surgery is recommended when the seizures can't be controlled with medication. Understandably, it's a rather frightening prospect and not an easy decision to make, but Gail was determined to try and improve her life. Dr. Andrew Bleasel is a neurologist specialising in epilepsy at Westmead Hospital in Sydney. And he says surgery is only suitable for people whose epilepsy is localised to one side of the brain, most commonly in the temporal lobe region. And accurately locating the affected area using brain imaging technology is key. He says that under 2% of all people with epilepsy undergo surgery in Australia.
So a small percentage, but because epilepsy is a very common disorder, that the numbers are significant in our sort of teaching hospital environment.
So what actually happens with surgery? What do you do?
The two principles of considering surgery are, one, to show that the seizures are confined to one spot, and then to show that that spot could be removed.
So it's actually removing brain tissue?
Oh, yes. Now, the best case for surgery is if there is a so-called lesion of the brain, and that could be a number of things, a tumour, a scar, a malformation of the brain. Now, that's a question that commonly people ask when you're discussing the prospect of surgery, that surely touching the brain and cutting it in that way would just leave further scarring. But in fact, the surgeon removes this largely by suction and some so-called diathermy, burning of blood vessels, to extract the area that's to be removed. It doesn't actually leave a scar as such, certainly not a scar that then produces seizures. So it's removed according to fairly standard neurosurgical techniques.
So because it's crucial to locate the problem so in such a definite way, I imagine that imaging techniques are absolutely crucial to this process.
Look, there's no doubt about that. The advent of modern imaging, especially the MRI scan, has led to a much greater use of epilepsy surgery and much more ready assessment of people for surgery. So prior to the modern imaging, it was a much different form of assessment. Nowadays, it's gone beyond the excitement of finding all of these lesions to the point where we now deal with people with a particular group where we know the epilepsy is quite localized, but we can't find a lesion on the MRI scan. And these people have actually earned themselves a label. These are referred to as non-lesional partial epilepsy, and that is one of the greatest challenges now to solve for epilepsy surgery.
And Gail Williams happens to fall into this difficult group Dr. Andrew Bleasel mentioned. Her epilepsy was not due to a brain lesion, and the problem was not in the temporal lobe, but in the parietal occipital lobe of her brain, which is related to vision. How did she feel after her surgery?
It was really painful afterwards, but then after the pain had gone and I hadn't had any seizures, I just felt different. And then gradually I got used to it, but I had still lost a bit of my upper left quadrant of vision, so I had to get used to that. I guess I still have a few difficulties, but it's going okay.
And did you notice that it affected your memory in any way?
Yeah, it affected my memory incredibly. Afterwards, I had trouble remembering different things at school, and adjusting to those different difficulties was a big strain on me emotionally. But now, after adjusting, it's been okay.
So how did you feel about it immediately after the surgery and as the time went on?
I was happy to see Gail being able to be a normal teenager and just to live a normal life. I mean, it's been a difficult time since the surgery. It hasn't just been all easy sailing. She went through a bit of a grieving period.
I just longed for the fit man and the seizures. And I was confused because I didn't understand why. Like, why would I want them back? And it took great understanding to realise, but they were my comfort. They took me from the outside world and just gave me this safe place.
So how often do you have seizures now?
I haven't had a single one since the surgery.
That's dramatic.
It's fantastic.
You must have been so relieved.
Very.
16-year-old Gail Williams with her mother, Jenny. And Gail is now doing well at school in year 12. Dr. Andrew Bleasel says that in those patients who undergo surgery, 70 to 80% can expect vast improvement. And he recommends that people shouldn't hesitate to at least be assessed for surgery if they are in the minority of people for whom medication isn't working. So Gail's surgery seemed to be successful and she's very happy with the outcome. She's been seizure-free, although she does have still problems with her memory. Is that common?
Yes, that is common. I think that that's unlikely to be related to the surgery, as we weren't anywhere near those circuits within the brain. But something that's very evident is that those people that have an onset of epilepsy, and hers was when she was very young, about 4 years old, may in fact have learning difficulties and memory difficulties that outlast successful treatment of the epilepsy, either with medication or surgery. Now, one of the great challenges is to work out why that is. Now, another very important thing that you couldn't miss saying, and I don't know whether we can solve this yet, is whether the drugs we use can be affecting learning and memory. And a lot of parents and patients with epilepsy are very concerned about that. But the evidence would suggest it's a comorbidity that goes with the epilepsy and the severity of the epilepsy rather than the treatment of the epilepsy. But unfortunately, we're not showing dramatic improvements despite treating the epilepsy.
You're with All in the Mind on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, and via podcast on your portable MP3 player. I'm Lynne Malcolm, and we're exploring the mysterious and often devastating condition of epilepsy. Another option for a tiny minority of patients is a battery-powered implant called a vagus nerve stimulator, which can prevent or reduce the severity of seizures. Dr. Ernie Somerville from the Prince of Wales Hospital in Sydney.
It's been found that electrical stimulation of the vagus nerve, which is one of the main nerves from the brain, which controls all sorts of things, including the heart and the stomach, stimulation of that nerve can reduce the occurrence of seizures. So vagus nerve stimulation consists of the implantation beneath the skin of a small device like a heart pacemaker, and it has some wires which pass underneath the skin and attach to the nerve in the neck. Every 5 minutes, the device is switched on for 30 seconds and provides little electrical impulses into the vagus nerve. They travel up to the brain, and in some mysterious way, which nobody really understands fully, they can reduce seizures.
Valerie Dredge has had epilepsy since she was 12, and it couldn't be controlled by drugs or surgery. She had the vagus nerve stimulator implanted 7 years ago, and she's just had the battery renewed.
So at the moment you've got some plaster just over your chest there, and that's where the stimulator is.
Yeah. If I know a seizure's coming on, I've got a magnet, I've got to grab it and put it like here. The seizure might have just started, say for 5 seconds. It'll stop it then and there.
And that feeling that indicates that you're about to have a seizure, tell me what it's like.
Well, usually now I know because I get a twinging feeling down the side of my left eye, side of your brain. It's like a fullness. It's not a pain, it's a stinging feeling. And I think, oh yeah, don't tell me something's coming on. I just persevere with it. Another 5 seconds, and it gets stronger. So I used to get real bad seizures where they used to go right down the side of into my left arm and into my left leg, but I don't get all that anymore. It's just in the left side of the face. But now I'll be able to use the magnet, and it won't go to the face anymore, hopefully.
Yeah, the magnet essentially is a way of switching on the device. The device switches on automatically every 5 minutes, but if it happens to be switched off at the time when a seizure occurs, and some patients can feel their seizure starting, then they can switch the device on by placing a magnet over the top of it, or one of their family or carers can do the same thing. And that may abort the seizure, or it may shorten the duration of the seizure.
And before Valerie Dredge had her implant, she couldn't even leave the house alone.
So overall, this has made a significant difference to your life?
Yeah, it's given me a better quality of life, and I feel like anybody else out there, you know. All right, I can't drive all that, but at least I can get out there and do anything else.
Valerie Dredge. She's been one of the lucky people who's benefited from the stimulator, and it does give her a sense of control. But Dr. Ernie Somerville says that this device is not widely used because it's expensive and the success rate has not been very high. Despite the progress that's been made with drugs, surgery and new technology, there's still a lot that is unknown about epilepsy. Australia leads the world in research into the genetics of epilepsy, and Professor Sam Berkovic is at the front line as director of the Comprehensive Epilepsy Program at the Austin Hospital in Melbourne, where they've identified a number of genes associated with the disorder. He says it can run in families, but not in a predictable way, and also that the stigma around epilepsy has made research a little more difficult. I asked him how the new genetic information is going to help with diagnosis and treatment. Sam Berkovic.
At the moment, the number of genes that have been found, with perhaps the percent of people with epilepsy where we found the genes, is relatively small. But as that grows, the genetics will become part of the sort of diagnostic armamentarium. It's still not a routine thing, although there are tests available for certain forms of epilepsy already available because of this work. Secondly, the great increase in knowledge that we've got about the clinical genetics, in other words, how the conditions are inherited, is of great importance in genetic counselling, and this is something we use every day practically in talking to our patients and families with epilepsy. What's the chance that my child will have the condition, or if I've got it, or if my siblings have got it, etc.? And we're now in a much more powerful position to give accurate information about that. And finally, by understanding the fundamental causes of epilepsy at a genetic level and at a biochemical level, we hope that that's going to lead to better therapeutics.
So what's the research that you're working on at the moment that you'd be most excited about?
Well, the area that we found perhaps to be the most important, or the most important gene so far to be important for epilepsy, is a gene for what we call a sodium channel. Sodium, as you know, is salt, and the salt levels in the brain and in the blood are extremely important for the way cells work, and particularly excitable cells like nerve cells. So we and a number of other groups around the world have found a variety of changes in the neuronal sodium channel, which regulates the way the sodium gets into the cell, cause a variety of epilepsies. And we've really been surprised at the spectrum of conditions that changes in these sodium channels can cause. And testing for changes in this sodium channel is now relevant to clinical practice, particularly for a severe group of childhood epilepsies, where we think early diagnosis and treatment may well change the outcome for these children.
Can you use this sort of information to find out why some drugs work with some people and not with others, and then there are some unlucky people who don't respond to medication at all?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very topical question. There's a whole new field of what we call pharmacogenetics, which is the genetic determinants of the way we respond to drugs. And you're absolutely right that two patients with an apparently similar form of epilepsy, one might respond extremely well and the other might respond extremely poorly. We're trying to understand the reasons for that. One of the reasons may be that their fundamental cause of their epilepsies is different, but there might be other causes. For example, there may be genetic differences that stop the drug being absorbed, or stop the drug getting into the brain, or increase the rate the drug's broken down. And this is a very new and emerging field. Now, applying that in the clinic is still some way off, but we've got at least now the tools to start to probe that.
Sam Berkovic from the University of Melbourne, whose work offers hope for future treatment of epilepsy. Lastly, to Gail Williams. So has this experience triggered an interest in matters of the brain for you?
It has, incredibly, and epilepsy itself, I guess. I guess I hope to go somewhere there in future prospects. You can always fulfil your dreams, and don't ever let anyone hold you back even though you have the condition. I guess even though there was this significant adjustment period afterwards that took me on this great emotional roller coaster, I guess now I can say it was worth it.
Thanks to Gail Williams, her mother Jenny, and to Valerie Dredge for their willingness to tell their stories about living with epilepsy. Today's program was produced by Pauline Newman with sound engineer Jenny Parsonage. Don't forget to visit our website at abc.net.au/rn. I'm Lynn Malcolm, and join me next week for All in the Mind on ABC Radio National, because I'll be speaking with a fascinating psychiatrist with a PhD in English literature, and she's delved into what makes a creative brain. Don't miss it.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.